earth will we do? That's the question as the new year rushes forward to meet us. This is Paul Rowan here on Wednesday Talk Radio. We are talking once again about climate change. Will 2018 top the climate chaos of 2017? I know that's kind of a ridiculous, provocative question that my guest Paul Beckwith probably wouldn't even want to attempt to answer, but we're going to talk about a lot of related questions with my guest Paul Beckwith, physicist, engineer, and now a part-time professor at the University of Ottawa. He's in a PhD program with a focus on abrupt climate system change that has to do with the atmosphere, oceans, Arctic, and methane. He earned a Master's of Science in Laser Optics and Physics. He's on the line with us from Ottawa. Good morning, Paul.
Hello, Paul. How are you?
So I introduced you already. I started talking a little bit about what's going on with methane levels. I'd like to explore in depth with you. Again, the title was, Will 2018 Top the Climate Chaos of 2017? I'm certainly not calling on you to answer that question, but I think you might have some ideas given what's been happening in the last 5 to 10 years, specifically what happened last year, what's happening in the Arctic now, to maybe give us some ideas of what some possible scenarios are. But to start out with, talk about what the heck is going on in the Arctic.
Yeah, so I think the answer to your question is, from year to year, there's variability, but the sea ice is not forming properly this winter, like last winter. It's super warm. The extent, I think it's about 12 million square kilometers, which is a record low for this time of year. I mean, it should be forming and getting up to about 15, but it's only about 12, and it's quite thin, and there's a lot of export out the Fram Strait between Greenland and Svalbard. So it's temperatures in the Arctic. I mean, the cold air in the Arctic, basically think of it as a big mass of air, big blob of air that normally, covers the sea ice area, and that's shifted down, and we see it in North America. Right. So the temperature and the temperature anomalies, or the temperature relative to what it would normally be, is way, way colder over North America, as people are experiencing. And it's way, way warmer than normal over the Arctic. We're talking about, 15, 20 degrees Celsius over vast regions. So the Arctic is continuing to get darker because it's losing sea ice, which is very bright white color, and snow covering the land. And when the sea ice goes, it's dark water underneath, which absorbs more sunlight. And it's when the snow goes on the land, it's dark permafrost underneath. So the Arctic is darkening. It may not seem like it's darkened much. I mean, it's gone from about the average reflectivity, if you like, was about 52% a few decades ago, and it's down to less than 48%, according to the NASA Ceres satellite. So it's darker, it's absorbing more energy, so it's warming a lot faster, and that's having huge repercussions on the jet streams.
And it's the jet stream fluctuations that's causing the cold temperatures to move south, is that right?
Yeah, so the jet stream, think of a wavy band that circles right around the Earth at high latitude, and it acts like a wall. It separates the cold, dry air in the Arctic from the more humid, warmer air further south at lower latitudes. So this the waves in the jet stream are much more pronounced. So the trough of the wave comes right down, and right now it's covering North America, deep down into the U.S., and the ridge of the wave is going right up into the Arctic. So the troughs are, so all the cold air from the Arctic is going down into that trough covering us in North America, and then hot air is going up, hot humid air is going up into the ridge, which is covering the Arctic right now. So in a nutshell, yeah, we've just reversed states with the Arctic, really.
Which is in a,
you know,
in a,
I don't know. You could
go
North
ahead.
North America is the new Arctic, and the Arctic is, you know, what we had. So it's a topsy turvy situation, and it's only going to get more pronounced when, you know, when we lose more and more sea ice and snow cover. We're heading very rapidly to completely losing the sea ice in the Arctic. Probably by, you know, maybe by 2020, certainly within the next 5 years, I would say, which is far faster than scientists expected and far faster than any of the computer models have predicted.
But a little pushback, though, because, you know, I unfortunately go on these Facebook groups on climate, in which there's these just insane and kind of obscene, almost funny, if it weren't for the tragic nature of what's going on, I wouldn't even say debates, just sort of back and forth sniping between the what the deniers call the alarmists, I guess that would be you and me, and what we would call the denialists. And one of the talking points that they use is, oh, you know, they said that the sea ice was going to disappear by 2012, or, oh, they said the, you know, so that's the danger of making specific predictions, is that it gets used by the other side to sort of claim that, oh, look, you know, it's all fake news. So, you know, give us give us your best explanation of what's really going on with the sea ice. You know, what the difference between thickness and extent of sea ice. Talk more about the Arctic sea ice.
Okay, so the when you make a sort of a prediction, okay, you know, if it's a one line sort of news bite, you know, you say, okay, the sea ice is going quickly, you know, and I expect it to be gone by, you know, within the next 5 years. So what am I basing that on? You know, what are the details behind that? It's the trend, right? If you look at the trend, you know, there's going to be year-to-year fluctuation. But if you look at the trend is exponentially heading downward. So that's faster than linear. It's heading exponentially down to zero. And what trend am I talking about? I'm talking about the trend in sea ice extent, which is defined as any region on the surface where there's at least 15% ice coverage. So we have 85% open water and 15% ice as seen from above by a satellite. Then that pixel or region will be included in the sea ice extent number. You know, when it drops below the 15% ice, then it's just considered water. You have to have a cutoff somewhere. The sea ice area is where there's all ice. There's no open water, so it's 100% ice. And we use the word concentration to sort of define that. So 100% concentration is included in sea ice area, and in sea ice extent is 15% concentration. And then, of course, we have the thickness, which is more difficult to determine, but we do have satellites now that measure actually the freeboard of the ice, the amount of the ice that's sticking up above the water. And if we know the density of the ice, which we can estimate, you know, accurately, I mean, it varies a bit depending on salt content, then we can figure out the thickness, and then we can calculate a volume. So all of these numbers, all these measures are dropping exponentially. And if you just follow the trend line, around 2020-ish, 2020, you know, maybe early 2020s, they go to zero. So all I'm saying, if the trend continues, then it's going to zero. I mean, that's a very scientific statement. You know, if the trend doesn't continue, if there's some feedback, which negative feedback, if you like, or something, if there's some feedback that slows down the process and breaks us away from that trend, then it can last a little bit longer. But it's certainly the observations of what is happening are way, way faster than the computer models that say, oh, the ice will be around till 2040, 2050 happen. Now, the idea of making predictions in the past, you know, you can always be wrong with predictions, right? So, you know, it's your best knowledge at the time. And, you know, back a number of years ago, the best knowledge, you know, we had some massive dips of ice. So from 2011 to 2012, I mean, the 2012 dropped off a cliff. So back in 2012, when it dropped off a cliff, there's always some people are saying, well, if it drops off a cliff like it did in 2012, in 2013 and 2014, then it's all gone. It's vanished, okay? So that's all that's happening. People are looking at what happens in, you know, and saying they think this is going to happen. And then if they're wrong, well, it doesn't mean the ice is growing back. I mean, right? So deniers have no, they have no leg to stand on. I mean, they're full of hot air. They're ideologically, whether they're lying intentionally, whether they're scared of what's happening and their emotional state won't allow them to accept the black and white that's in front of them, you know, I mean, we can talk to psychologists about why they stick to their nonsense, basically. And, you know, there's a reason it's called denial, because if the evidence and the facts are there and they just don't want to see them. So the ice is, you know, thinning. There's not much of it there. It's behaving differently in many different ways. For example, you know, it used to get pushed up against the Canadian islands, the Canadian archipelago, and there would be ice bridges sort of there, and they would stop the ice from sort of trickling through between the islands. But now the ice is so broken up that those ridges are very weak, and they don't form in some cases. So the ice just sort of goes between all those islands and goes further south and where it can melt out. Same thing in the places like the Nares Strait, which is a narrow channel. The ice just goes straight through, whereas there used to be an ice bridge. There's a lot more wave action in the Arctic. The waves are churning up the water and bringing up warmer water from below up to the ice, contributing to the melt. There's a lot more export of ice out of the Arctic, so it's not just melting from the top and melting from the below because of the warm ocean temperatures. It's also being exported out into the Atlantic where it melts off. So it's rapidly going. I mean, you just have to open your eyes and look for yourself. And, you know, people that have closed minds and say, like, I just don't understand the human psychology of denying something that is right in front of you. It's like me looking at a picture, you know, or looking at the blue sky and saying, no, the sky's not blue, it's green or it's orange or...
Well, the Arctic is a long way from where most people live, which is one thing. Then, of course, there's, yes, as you mentioned, ideology. I mean, we're all of us who grow up in modern culture are steeped in various kinds of ideologies. Obviously, people who are scientifically inclined feel that science. And I think are, to a large extent, correct that, you know, science has some built-in mechanisms to kind of bracket off ideology and to allow for, you know, empirical evidence to take the fore. Of course, that's not always the case, and it's a very complex discussion. But so, you know, we're all so many people have these ideological, you know, that's the air we breathe from the very beginning. You know, if we grow up in a family that's whatever, evangelical, or if we grow up in a family that's this, that, or the other thing, we tend to, you know, adopt those colorations. And then, you know, what we get from the mass media, what we get, you know, the fact that nobody's really talking in detail the way you're talking, people just don't get that. You have to go far afield. So anyway, all these factors lead to the fact that, you know, we have, unless we have a strong personal inclination or desire to break through these ideological filters or obstacles or whatever, you know, the path of least resistance is to just sort of not pay that much attention. And obviously everybody's so, you know, busy, and it, as you said, it's so scary. There's all these things that we, you know, need to be cognizant of, because we can't just condemn people for being what they are. But anyway, it does lead to the disastrous situation that, you know, there's not enough people clamoring for NPR or CNN or whoever to actually talk about what's going on just with the Arctic sea ice. I mean, who is talking about this Arctic sea ice the way you are now?
Yeah, I mean, there's just a handful of people. You know, there's Peter Wadhams, there's people in the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, but the numbers are growing. The numbers of people that are recognizing what's going on are growing, and it's just that there's no the sense of, I mean, the climate doesn't really care, you know, what we believe or don't believe, or you know, it's rapidly changing, and it's just all one needs to do is look at the evidence, look at rod, and we can't all go up to the Arctic, as you said, so we can look at measures from the Arctic that we see. I mean, just look at the, you know, temperatures aren't behaving like they used to behave, right, around the planet. I mean, there's more extreme weather events. There's we're getting rainfall events, you know, at high latitudes, whether they be in the, you know, U.S. or Canada, and it's almost like you were living at the equator. You know, if you've been down to the Caribbean or some part close to the equator, sometimes you get these torrential rainfall events, and you know, it just seems like, I mean, it seems like we're the equator's moved up to we're up to higher latitude. We're getting those type of events, and that's because the jet streams are wavier and slower and getting stuck in place, and that's because the Arctic is super warm, so the temperature difference to the equator is much smaller, and that's the physics that sets up the, you know, jet streams. If we had no temperature difference, we would have no jet streams at all.
So you talk a lot about the Arctic, but you know, there's equally dramatic changes going on in the Antarctic. You know, you're talking about the way that the ice kind of buttresses the more solid,
yes,
the sea ice that does it prevents, yes, it from like flowing. So that's similar to what's going on in the Antarctic. Those buttresses, yes, are disappearing. So, but what influence does the Antarctic have on global climate? It doesn't sound like it has as much as the Arctic.
Well, the rapid drop of sea ice and snow cover in the Arctic means that the Arctic is warming much faster than anywhere else on the planet. And because it's warming from the additional absorption of sunlight, then there's less, it lowers the temperature difference to the equator, so there's less heat moving from the equator to the Arctic in the jet streams and ocean currents, the Gulf Stream, so those slow down. So the equator... So where does that heat go from the equator? Well, a lot of the heat at the equator goes into evaporating water, making it very humid there. But it also means that there's more heat transported from the equator south to the southern hemisphere. So that gets transported by the air circulation and ocean circulation to the southern hemisphere. It makes it down to Australia, and Australia, as people will tell you, is like an oven. You know, it's their summer now, and it's just incredibly hot, records being broken left, right, and center, lots of different rainfall events that are crazy, storms, high winds, etc. So the heat gets down there, but Antarctica is more isolated than the Arctic because the ocean goes clear all the way around Antarctica. So you can have the, you know, higher wind speeds and ocean currents that circumvent Antarctica, whereas you can't get that in the Arctic because of all the land masses in the way. So that kind of isolates Antarctica. But what's happening in Antarctica, you know, the warming is also very fast in Antarctica. But if you warm from minus 45 degrees Celsius to minus 40, you're not going to get ice melting. Right, so the warming down there is not causing ice to melt at the surface so much. But the ocean currents, which are warmer, are going underneath the ice, as they always do, and now the ocean currents are warmer, so they're melting the ice in Antarctica from below. So, and we can measure this with these gravity anomaly satellites, these GRACE satellites. So Antarctica is losing lots of ice mass on the continent, as is Greenland, but it's not seen to have such a big effect. But the southern hemisphere is vital for the climate system. I always tell people, you know, try to think of the connections, try to join the dots. Don't just think of one thing. When you hear something in climate, try to think of how it relates to other things, and you start building up a picture of how the whole system works and how it will respond to a certain change. So what's been happening in Antarctica is, you know, as the Arctic's been warming over the last number of decades, there's more heat going to the southern hemisphere, so there's a higher temperature difference to Antarctica, so the jet streams around Antarctica have been increasing, and those have been pulling the sea ice out. So the sea ice has actually been increasing in extent around Antarctica about 1.5% per decade, you know, which is, you know, a little bit. But in the last few years, that system is broken a bit. And what's happening is we're getting record losses of sea ice in Antarctica as well. So if you actually add the total sea ice area in Antarctica to that in the Arctic, we're seeing severe drops in the last few years. And once again, it's happening this year. And part of the reason why the sea ice extent in Antarctica is controlled a lot by upwelling of ocean current. So upwelling of water and downwelling, where that happens. And so it depends a bit on the bathymetry, like the topography, if you like, of the seafloor around Antarctica, because there's some regions where there's underwater sort of mountains that, you know, they're not poking above the surface, but, you know, are large changes in depth. And the water, when it hits that, it can be pushed upwards, and sort of that can be a limit as to where the sea ice is in that region. So there's that sort of thing going on. So like I say, the devil's always in the detail, but the bottom line is, yeah, the Antarctic is not not healthy. It's part of the climate system. It's very vital, this downwelling, in order to sequester carbon, store it in the deep, you know, bring it down deep, and then it goes into the seafloor sediments and stuff, and is, you know, removed from the atmosphere ocean cycle of carbon. So it's a huge sink of carbon in that region. So when those currents are changing, then that has bad implications to levels in the atmosphere, for example.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. I'm speaking, my name is Paul Rowan. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm speaking with a physicist, engineer, and now a part-time professor at the University of Ottawa, Paul Beckwith. He's in a PhD program with a focus on abrupt climate system change. And he has a website, paulbeckwith.net, where he has some easy to understand YouTube videos and some blogs. And we're talking with him. He's from Ottawa. And so the number to call in, this is a talk show, and I haven't given the number yet, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, with your questions and comments. You know, as always, there's so much to cover and so little time, but we've talked about the Arctic sea ice, we've talked about the Antarctic, started talking about the ocean dynamics. The kind of the question I posed provocatively, will 2018 top the climate chaos of 2017, is, you know, very pointedly, because, you know, here in Portland, we didn't, in Oregon, Southern Washington, those who are listening by radio wave frequencies, this is our listening area, we, you know, have really been relatively fortunate in terms of effects of climate change. We certainly saw a mega fire just to the east of us, which came disconcertingly close to the metropolitan area, almost got to Troutdale. And, you know, was largely in uninhabited areas, you know, didn't have the kinds of effects that devastating effects on people's houses, property, lives, that some of those Southern California and Northern California wildfires did last year. But we certainly know people probably affected by them, certainly saw them on the news, so that's an effect. But, you know, we certainly didn't have the kind of damage that Houston did, that Puerto Rico did, that the Virgin Islands did, that Florida did. So we're you know, relatively safe for the time being from these dramatic, devastating impacts of climate change. But that's not to say that we will be for forever. Plus, it seems very real that we are definitely getting a lot of climate and economic refugees. To what extent they're climate refugees is really hard to know, but certainly some of the people moving here from California probably directly or indirectly have been impacted by the droughts, the fires, and that will only likely get more severe. So it's a, you know, these are knock-on effects. The economic impacts are multiple. So and other impacts. So getting back to the, I guess, well, let's just go to our first caller before I repose that question. Will 2018 top the climate chaos of 2017? We got Dougie on the line. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, Paul, it's me, Dougie.
Yeah, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah.
I was just letting Paul know it's Dougie out here in Atlanta. Paul, could you talk about how, you know, the rapid melt of the sea ice, and you were talking about how it affects the jet stream. Could you delve into how this weather weirding with the jet stream will increase drought and extremely affect our food production and food supply in the future? Could you talk a little bit about that?
I think that's one of the big weaknesses of human society is it's sort of been like we don't have food stored, so generally there's geographical resilience. So if crops fail in one country, then they just export more from the global markets. Maybe there's a bumper crop somewhere else. So the big problem is that because the jet stream changes, cause extreme weather events, you know, around the planet. I mean, mostly we're Northern Hemisphere centric, right? We talk about, you know, most of the land areas and the food growth areas are in the Northern Hemisphere. So if the jet stream, say, cause torrential rains and flood out fields in one region, you know, that would be in the ridge of a very wavy jet stream that doesn't move, that's persistent. And then in the trough of the jet stream, we get these torrential rains causing flooding fields, you know, wiping out crops in that region. If we get crop failures in multiple regions, we have no food stored. I mean, it would cause so there'll be, you know, food shortages just from basic economic supply and demand. The prices will double or triple or quadruple, and many people in, you know, we'll all be complaining in North America, but, you know, we won't, a lot of people, you know, I mean, if food prices double or triple or quadruple, you know, most people, you know, lots of people in North America won't starve, right? They'll figure out some way to get some food. But it's people who are spending, you know, half their income right now in developing countries that will just go without. And so there'll be huge unrest. You know, there's nothing like food shortages to bring people out into the streets. I mean, look at the Arab Spring crisis. So this is a huge problem. This is something that there are some buffers, fortunately, with food, because we waste about a third of the food that we produce, at least a third. right? So if food prices spike up, you know, our waste will drop to zero probably, you know, when the prices are much higher. So that gives us about a third of more food than, and there's also, you know, people will start eating a lot less meat and so on. And you can get a lot more nutrients and calories out of eating the grains and stuff directly rather than it having go through the, you know, livestock and so on. There'll be large surpluses of meat, right? When there's a lack of food, you know, then we won't be feeding the livestock. The livestock will be killed and their meat will supply food for people. So there are buffers in the system, but it's our weakness, if you like. You know, you play these strategy games online and you have strengths and weaknesses. Well, all of our characters in these games, you know, I mean, we need to drink water, we need to eat food. So those are definite areas that are vulnerable when the extreme weather events increase a lot more, which I believe that they will do. I think they will certainly do as we lose sea ice and snow cover in the Arctic and go to an open ocean in the Arctic.
Thank you for calling, Dougie. We've got another caller. Hold on for just a second. You know, so we've talked before a couple times on the air. I've had other people talking about the dire situation that we're in. But, you know, of course, now we've got this Trump administration, which is sort of enshrining denialism as public policy and has brought in the fossil fuel barons who are seeming to start to possibly lose some of their economic and political influence, enshrine them as the brain trust of the Trump administration. It seems like it's gotten worse, at least in the United States, not better in terms of responding. But at the same time, even though, you know, we had the Paris Accords and, you know, we continue to have these large-scale summits, but they're, you know, largely based, they're based on watered-down politicized versions of the IPCC report, the International Panel on Climate Change, Governmental Panel on Climate Change, which itself is based upon these computer models, which aren't really taking into effect the more real-time dynamics of climate change. So you've got a series of factors which are basically limiting our ability, and there still is really no coordinated response on the planet Earth towards this crisis which is enveloping us as we speak. You've been critical as well of the, speaking of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, you've been critical of your own colleagues in their own failure to come to grips with what's going on. You were just at the American Geophysical Union meeting down in New Orleans. I was wondering if you could talk about what you feel is the response or lack thereof in the scientific community itself.
Well, there's there's a lot of awareness in the scientific community on an individual level as to what's happening with climate, but we're basically, let's face it, I mean, our society is geared, like, we're basically a planet of specialists, right? In order for people to get ahead in their careers, they have to become more and more specialized, and delve deeper and deeper into a very narrow area, if you like. And that's just not good enough. That's not conducive to solving problems like climate change, because you know, it's all encompassing. Everything is connected to everything else. Things are one thing's changing, causing these knock-on effects, as you called it, or I call them cascading effects, or feedback effects. So there just was no sense. There wasn't that sense of urgency at the AGU meeting with the scientists. I didn't sense. I go to lots of these types of meetings. This is my first AGU, but for example, the climate conference in Lima, COP 20, COP 21 in Paris. I went to those conferences, and there just wasn't the sense of urgency amongst the policymakers. And so wherever I go and talk about climate, there's just not that. I just don't see a sense of urgency, and I think that sense is going to rapidly come, I really think that the sea ice, loss of sea ice, will accelerate sort of human understanding of how risky it is. I mean, we're playing with fire here literally. Like I've been saying for quite a while that we need to declare a global climate change emergency and sort of bring up all the resources that we have to address this situation that we find ourselves in, because business as usual is just not conducive to supporting life on this planet for that much longer. So we need to first of all get people on board, the public on board, governments on board. We're in a climate emergency. Our survival and the survival of species inhabiting this planet is at risk. And then what do we do? Well, everybody's been talking about slashing fossil fuel emissions, but that's not really happening. I mean, when you see the indicator for me, basically, I don't think we've done hardly anything to address climate change and we've had, we're up to COP 23. That's 23 years of talking, chitter chatter, and emissions are still rising. We need to slash fossil fuel emissions, but that's not, we've left it too late for that to do the trick itself. So up until a few years ago, I was against the idea of geoengineering, which is sort of broken into carbon dioxide removal and solar radiation management. But I came to the conclusion a number of years ago that we don't have any choice now. We have to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. And we have to apply solar radiation management, deploy solar radiation management to cool the planet, to buy us enough but cut the warming off, to give us time to slash our fossil fuel emissions and pull CO2 out of the atmosphere. And if we don't do that, temperature will continue to accelerate. We're very liable to have, a 5-degree temperature rise in a decade or two. There's precedence for this. And the changes that are happening in all different, anything you measure to do with climate, the changes are happening much faster than they've ever happened before on this planet. And, we have our fingerprint all over it. And, we inadvertently, without thinking through our industry and everything else, we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere and oceans, and we have the ability to think and reason and put things into place to do things collectively. I mean, look at the Montreal Protocol to get rid of ozone, to get rid of things that were destroying the ozone, right? And so once our back is to the wall and we act collectively, then I'm pretty confident that we'll have a fighting chance to reverse what some of the things that we've done and get some climate stability again.
Well, let's go to a caller. Edie, if you're still waiting patiently, go ahead, you're on the air.
Thank you. Can you tell me where I can find research, if it's being done at all? And if not, who it can leverage to make the research on the results of the testing with sonar heat for petroleum, et cetera, under the oceans and the nuclear weapon explosions and the use of HARP, especially in the Arctic, breaking up sea ice, warming up the water, killing whales and then changing the patterns of heat flow of air and water?
Well, in my videos, I show a lot of a lot, like I have different styles of videos. Some of them are just sort of ranting as I'm walking outside somewhere, or just sitting in front of the camera, you know, in a room with books behind me. But I do have Blackboard presentations. I do have lots of presentations in my videos where I show different websites, and they're all, you know, with Google, you know, you see a website on a video or something, it's very easy to Google and find it. So, but as far as sonar studies and stuff, it's just, you know, you can always call people at universities, right? You can always just find, you know, if you live close to a university, you know, you can just go to their website, see who's studying climate, see who's studying some topic, you know, similar to yours, and just give them a call and say, I'd like to come in and meet with you and have a coffee, and I have some questions to ask you about, you know, about some things. And most people are very amenable to doing that. So you can directly talk to people. You have to be very careful because there's a lot of misinformation out there. So like at the AGU conference, 25,000 or 24,000 scientists, for example, you know, if you go to Google AGU 2017 and you get to their website and you can look at the schedule and it gives you abstracts, sort of a little blurb about the different talks, and you can do searches for topics. And if you do a search for HARP, for example, you won't find a single thing. So why is that? It's because it's not considered, it's not some cover-up or hidden thing. It's very difficult to cover up things. There'd be somebody talking about it. It's because people, you know, it's not connected to the weather. Scientists don't believe this. There's this thing in the public floating around that HARP is doing this and HARP is doing that. And it's just not, you know, it's not, you know, I disagree. I mean, it's not doing anything. It's not affecting anything. We put CO2 and greenhouse gases up into the atmosphere, and we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere and oceans, and the climate's responding. It's nothing to do with sending up waves. You know, that was an experiment done, and I don't even know if most of those stations were closed down. You know, in terms of military and sonar, I mean, you can contact the Navy, and you can say, I want to see, you know, send me the reports that you've done on...
They won't allow that for EIS and public disputes, but we don't want to have all this heating affecting our oceans. They won't allow the petroleum industry and the U.S. Navy are not letting us know where they're doing what with what heat differentials. They're not letting us know what the results are. So I'm wondering where I can find this.
But I think what Paul is saying is that I think he's implying that aside from the HARP thing, that the sonar, it might be having some impact on heating the oceans, but I think he's saying that would not be the dominant impact. And we're talking about the major impacts on climate change. So I think it's not, correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, it doesn't seem like it's directly relevant to the conversation.
A nuclear explosion is pretty hot.
Well, yes, but I mean we're not firing off nuclear explosions anywhere. I mean, North Korea does it underground every so often. I mean, above ground tests were banned after the bombs were all dropped on the Bikini Atolls, and you know, I think, you know, France was doing lots of open air testing and stuff. But I mean, there hasn't been any nuclear explosions.
We got to move on. We only have 10 minutes left. So thank you for calling, Edie, and we appreciate your call. And we got Harvey next up on the queue. Go ahead, Harvey.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for the show. And Paul, about solar management and geoengineering, Elon Musk said that in the next decade or so, we're going to need 3 times the amount of electricity because of electric cars and everything. And if we put a sunscreen around the Earth, it'll essentially kill the solar revolution. There'd be less sunlight falling to the planet, creating less solar electricity. And then because of that, we'll have to use more fossil fuels to create electricity. And so we'll possibly see an acceleration of the release of CO2 into the air. And I was wondering what your feeling on that is.
Yes, it's always important to consider. Usually, we're not talking about, you know, all or nothing things. There's always, scale is always important, like the scale on a size basis, and also the scale in the time scale, for example. I mean, with the time scale, you know, some people are saying, well, we're getting polar shifts and that's changing the climate. Well, polar shifts happen over a long, long period of time. It's not going to change things from one year to the next, which we're seeing the changes occurring on that scale. So in terms of the solar radiation management, we're only talking about a small fraction of a percentage change. So people wouldn't even notice it. It's such a tiny, tiny change. It's like, you know, there are change. I mean, we get clouds, the change in clouds, you know, clouds going overhead. I mean, there is variation. If you've got a solar collector, you know, there's changes in the aerosols in the atmosphere. You know, there can be fires and it puts these particles in the air, it cuts down the sun a little bit, things like that. So all of these things are happening sort of naturally. And we're just talking about a background change, which is a very small fraction of a percent, and we might want to just do it regionally in the Arctic, for example, to stop this crazy warming in the Arctic. And whenever a massive volcano goes off, it puts sulfur particles up into the stratosphere naturally, and then that can cool the planet. Like Pinatubo cooled the planet globally about half a degree for 3 years, something like that. There's been much larger volcanoes that have cooled the planet for, you know, a degree or more for 5 years. So we're talking about just a small fraction of what happens in one of these natural events, just sort of a background. Like it's like a little tiny volcano going off, you know, constantly, rather than having big periodic eruptions. So it's just this is one of the reasons. I mean, we know so much about what would happen if we actually did this. I mean, people are looking at more innocuous things, like, for example, marine cloud brightening. Okay, we have all these low-level clouds over the ocean. A lot of the marine clouds, they're formed, you know, they're all naturally formed clouds. There's lots of water vapor over the ocean because of the evaporation. But a lot of these clouds are very dark because the particles, the water droplets are very large. They absorb a lot of sunlight. So they actually cause cooling underneath. But what we could do is, if we somehow put in these lots of these little salt crystals, for example, like we take salt seawater, we pump it through nozzles, we make get these salt crystals, they go up. So instead of getting a whole bunch of, instead of getting large water droplets that absorb sunlight, we make really, really tiny droplets because they form on all these little particles, and so the clouds are whiter and they reflect sunlight. So they reflect sunlight back up to space. It doesn't come down and warm up the ocean. So there's lots of different ideas. Or we put these little tiny bubbles in the ocean, for example, is another idea. Generate all these little tiny bubbles. And if you make really, really small bubbles in the ocean, they can stick around for a long time and make the surface of the ocean more reflective.
The problem is
the ice, right? We're losing the ice, and so it's getting a lot darker. That's the problem.
So thank you, Harvey, for calling. We only have 5 minutes left if anybody else has a call. But so cutting to the chase, you know, you've put out a lot of ideas there in terms of potential technological geoengineering responses. But again, the reality seems to be that on none of these fronts, including the research and technology front, that seems to be locked up by the world's militaries and multinational corporations, who seem to be loath to devote much of a percentage of their budgets and their time and energy from making their profits to actually saving life on planet Earth. So what are some of the ideas that are actually getting some research and development time and treatment that seem to be possibly promising?
Okay, well, none of these things are getting much research and development funding at the moment. Almost none. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there was some military money looking at some of these projects, which we're not privy to that information. like the pain isn't severe enough to the general public. You know, this is not going away. Climate change is worsening. It's accelerating. It's not going away. It's going to be in everybody's face, in the public, in a matter of time. Whether it happened in a couple of years or in 5 years, I don't know the exact timing. It depends on, you know, how big bad the pain gets. If there's a food crisis, or you know, we lose sea ice, we lose a couple of major cities from because the ocean water is too warm, and these super storms, cause things. I mean, the climate change will bankrupt countries. It's already doing it. Look, how long do you think it'll take Puerto Rico to get fixed? The U.S. isn't invincible, right? The U.S. You could save a lot of money by getting rid of the tax revenue people and just having people write their tax checks to the military. I mean, it's coming down to that almost, right? Like, the military is getting such a large percentage of tax money in the U.S. And, you know, what about fixing? I mean, the infrastructure is being hammered. Cities are being, flooded out. And then it's taking an awful long time to recoup them. Insurance companies will go bankrupt. People won't be covered soon for climate change will bankrupt countries. The U.S. is no different from any other place. It'll just last longer than other countries, right?
It's okay, like, we got 1 minute left. We got 1 minute. I just want to ask you.
Money,
1 minute left. What kind of a major climate change impact do you potentially see for this year coming up?
It's really hard. I think I would definitely say a continuation of extreme weather events around the planet. Like every week, there seems to be some other flood or some other drought or some other climate related thing. So I see a continuation of that, and over the next number of years, I see a ramping up of that as we head to less and less sea ice and snow cover in the Arctic. So,
okay, we got to run. We're all plumb out of time. Thank you very much, Paul Beckwith. Really appreciate it.
Yes, thank
you. And paulbeckwith.net is his website for more information. Go to our webpage, our kbo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. This is Paul Rowan. Thanks so much.
Hello, KBOO listeners. Turn in Friday nights from 6 to 7 p.m. for Bread and Roses. This collective has been on air since 1978, making it the longest-running feminist news and public affairs radio show in the country. You can find Bread and Roses on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/breadandroses, or on Facebook at KBOO Bread and Roses Radio. We hope you tune in.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Scanner Foundation's 32nd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 15th at 8:30 a.m. at the Red Line Hotel on the River in Portland. This year, Nelson Senior Vice President of U.S. Strategic Community Alliances and Consumer Engagement, Cheryl Grace, will be the keynote speaker. Grace has been with Nelson for 13 years, and for the past 7 years has overseen the production of a report on Black consumers, and we'll speak about the power of the Black dollar. Again, that's the Scanner Foundation's 32nd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 15th at 8:30 a.m. at the Red Line Hotel on the River, 909 North Hayden Island Drive in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what's coming up for you for the next several hours here on KBOO. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. But first up, we've got The Politics of Living, the author of Among the Living and the Dead, Three Generations of Exile Along the War Roads of Europe, joins us.